You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
So today's panel is Universal Service Reform. Will somebody just please do it? The title reflects a bit of frustration. We have been sensing among a lot of different constituencies about the Universal Service Fund and how it is used to kind of fund broadband service throughout America in its different iterations. The point today is to get folks with different views on that particular subject, and we're going to go down the panel here. But just to start off, the original founders of the Congressional Internet Caucus were all from very rural states, Montana, rural Virginia, Vermont. Now we have Senator Thune from rural Dakotas, and we just ratted a few months ago Congresswoman Anna Eshoo as a co-chair of the Congressional Internet Caucus. So historically, she's been the one exception to the fact that the members of the chairman of the Congressional Internet Caucus have always been from rural states, which really reflects the fact that from its founding in 1996, which is an eternity ago in internet policy, that there was a deep concern among rural states and rural members of Congress that if their constituents did not have access to internet broadband, and internet in general, they'd be left out of a variety of different economic opportunities, cultural opportunities, and communication opportunities. So the Congressional Internet Caucus has always been aware of the importance of rural in its programming, and nothing is more to the point than universal service reform. So without belaboring what universal service reform is and what the fund is, let me just say that the NTIA just released their national broadband map last week, I believe it was. It's an astounding map that details broadband service and different types of internet service all across America. It is reported that 60%, only 60% of rural America have access to broadband internet. And the question for us today is, when you look at the Universal Service Fund, which is about an $8 billion a year at the moment fund to provide connectivity to all Americans, how in an age when broadband internet is taking off, how do we continue to use those funds to fund broadband and high capacity internet lines to all Americans, as opposed to what it was originally created for back in an eternity ago? So that said, let me just kind of go to our panelists. And starting from my right, I'm just going to briefly introduce you, and then we're going to just have 3 minutes of introductory comments, have discussion, debate, and then I really want to open it up for questions for the remainder of the panel after that. So we have with us today Shirley Bloomfield from the National Telecommunications Cooperative Association, NTCA, which is sometimes I always confuse with NCTA, which is the large cable trade association. Shirley began her career on Capitol Hill working for Congressman David Obey back when. She's been working in some capacity for NCTA since 1986, and now she's the CEO. Then to her right is Dr. Mark Cooper. And this is his second appearance before the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. Dr. Cooper has a PhD from Yale. He is the Director of Research for the Consumer Federation of America, where he has responsibility for telecommunications, media, digital rights, etc. And the PowerPoints that you find on your chair are Dr. Cooper's PowerPoints that I kind of mashed together for you, because you have a PowerPoint presentation. Then we have John Jones from CenturyLink, who was a professor at one point, and we can call him Doctor. He's Vice President for State Government Affairs at CenturyLink. There's a merger between CenturyLink and Quest, and following that merger, he'll be Vice President for Public Policy and Congressional Relations, so probably spending a lot more time here in Washington. But I don't know if you like that or not. Then to his right is Joel Lubin from AT&T, is Vice President for Federal Government Affairs. Joel is also responsible for developing public policy at the federal and state levels. Joel has been with the company for a very long time working on these issues, and he is a renowned expert on intercarrier compensation and universal service. And to his right, who needs no introduction, is Blair Levin. This is his, 15th time before the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. Usually he's moderator on these issues. But today, he's our panelist. Blair is the Communications and Society Fellow at the Aspen Institute. Before that, he was with the Federal Communications Commission working on the National Broadband Plan. Before that, he was with Stifel Nicholas. Before that, which was, it was Lake Mason, and then before that, he was one of the six commissioners of the Federal Communications Commission as chief of staff to Reed Hunt, I believe. And then before that, you were in North Carolina working for a law firm. So with that said, let me just go down the list, and we just have very brief introductory remarks. Universal Service Fund, what's the problem? How do we fix it? How do we fund it? And where do we go from there?
Sure. Okay, 3 minutes. Just a very brief overview. We represent about 600 small rural telecom companies that serve in about 45 states. And Vermont folks provide communication services in those areas where larger companies didn't want to serve because they're very high cost, they're very low density. A lot of you who are congressional staff folks, particularly those in the Senate, everybody's got some rural parts of their territory. And the universal service model is one that's been very important in terms of actually getting advanced services and communication services, both voice and data, out into these markets. Because what you've got is you've got carriers who actually really cannot build a business model for bringing out services, particularly as we evolve into a broadband world. And one of the things that I think has been very important about the debate regarding USF has been the whole evolution to how you take it from a voice model to a broadband model. And how do you ensure that broadband becomes the next service that is really necessary for economic development in rural America and for, frankly, the entire country? One of the things that just I always think is important is USF gets put in this kind of bubble about it's all about the money. It's a pot of money. Universal service is really, it's a law and it's a policy that was implemented and codified in the 96 Telecom Act. And it was put in there because of the recognition that these areas of the country are very difficult to provide service to. So we think it's really important to kind of shift away from looking at it as a pot and really thinking about what you're trying to accomplish from a policy perspective and how much you're really committed to actually putting services in these areas. You know, on one hand, you've got all these stimulus dollars that are kind of rolling out for a lot of these broadband projects, and then you've got USF out there. And I would also say that certainly one of the things people expect is for us as the rural entities to say, you know, we like USF the way it is. It's done a great job in rural America, and we'll be the first to say it has done a great job. Our companies provide service to about 92%, broadband service to 92% of their service territory. That's incredibly impressive and incredibly important. But I would also say that, yes, the time has come for us to be looking at USF reform and to be doing it thoughtfully and working with the FCC. To be working with the rest of the industry on what that reform looks like. And the last point in my 3 minutes that I'd like to just kind of lay out is everybody also gets very tied up with how big the fund is. Tim referenced the size of the current fund is $7, $8 billion right now. The high-cost portion of the fund is about $4.3 billion, and that includes rural carriers, that includes non-rural carriers, that includes CLECs, that includes rural CLECs. So there's a number of entities that draw from that. The rural portion of the USF High Cost Fund is $2 billion. So I think it is, it's when you start to think about what a tool that has been and what a successful model that has been to build broadband out in these rural communities, again, that's another piece of that puzzle that I think is going to be very important going forward. The other thing about universal service is that there's some pieces tied to it. When you are receiving universal service, you have carrier last resort obligations. That means that you are entitled and the requirement is to provide service to every customer that you have. That's another very important piece in ensuring that all Americans have access to comparable services at comparable prices.
Oh, that was fantastic. That was really close to 3 minutes. I'm really impressed. Dr. Cooper. And everybody has Dr. Cooper's slides in color.
Before I start, though, I really do have to object to this eternity business with the 96 Act. If the 96 Act is eternity, the first time I testified on the 96 Act was 1982. So that's many eternities ago.
To put it in perspective, Dr. Cooper, I'll challenge you on this. Everybody see the YouTube video of Katie Couric and Ryan Gumbel trying to figure out what the internet was in 1995? You ever see that YouTube video? Just to put it in perspective, the general public did not really quite understand what the internet was until late 90s. So I think for policymaking, it is an eternity. But I appreciate
it. Well, no, and I agree with that. And actually, so now I'll stop my 3 minutes. But the first slide that you have shows the public policy challenge in more stunning fashion than almost anything I have seen in the 32 years I've been doing this. If you look on the left side, what you see is that the 96 Act replicated the old style of using toll revenues, interstate toll revenues, to support local access lines. That was the model for the 20th century. It made perfectly good sense because you couldn't complete a long-distance interstate call without having a local access line. And so it was clearly necessary to have local access lines. You'll observe on that slide, however, that the first decade of the 21st century blew that model away. In 10 years, it was annihilated. Toll revenue evaporated, local access lines have plummeted. In contrast, on the left side, wireless has expanded to become the largest single source of revenue in the industry, and broadband internet access actually has, if you combine all of the wired and wireless, more access points than local access. The world has changed. The universal service program has not. That's the challenge. It's so 20th century what we did, and it was still the end of the 20th century. Below that, you have a slide which shows you that this is, in fact, a global phenomenon. The wireless revolution, the digital wireless revolution, is the greatest communications revolution in the history of the species. Far and away, all previous revolutions involved a small sliver of the human race being able to communicate better, whether it was alphabet or whether it was the printing press. This revolution means everybody can communicate with everybody. That is a revolution of immense proportions. If we turn over to the next slide, you discover the central economic proposition facing us is that wireless is much less costly in low and moderate density areas, while it is competitive in high-density areas. That's why the rest of the world is doing wireless, not wireline. If you don't have a wire in place today, any place on this planet, you will not pull it. You will go wireless. You'll need lots of wires for backbone to aggregate the traffic and maybe the middle mile, but you will not pull a first-mile wire to connect people. And that's essentially a cost question. The real challenge comes, I believe, because, in my opinion, bandwidth has a dramatically declining function, marginal functionality. Wired broadband lets you do everything almost nowhere, that is, in one place where the wire ends. 4G wireless lets you do lots of things everywhere because you carry it in your pocket. Does anybody in this room not have a cell phone? Raise your hand. 15 years ago, when I asked that question, almost nobody in the room had a cell phone. Mobility is an essential value function in the 21st century. It is future-proof. Mobility will be the centerpiece of communications in the 20th century until telepathy replaces electronic signaling as a transmission medium. That said, I believe that 4G is the sweet spot. And we should, in fact, focus on 4G to deliver broadband as an adequate facility at reasonable charges. Lots of policy changes have to be undertaken, but we have to keep our eye on the prize. Ubiquitous, affordable, adequate, a magic word, that communications access adequate facilities at reasonable charges. That's where we need to go, and it really is. Beyond that, just about the money. But at the end of 10 years, we need to have thoroughly reformed this so we're delivering broadband to everybody in the country. Thank you. Great. Thank you. John?
Well, thank you. Good afternoon. So we're here talking about a program that was created before most everybody in this room was born and put in perspective before I was born. And so I've really wrestled with how to talk about this with this group and relate it to the internet. And it's really not that hard. I think the main thing is that if you look at universal service as a program first and to look at the good things that are in that program, help for low-income customers, affordable comparable services for your residential constituents, small businesses, et cetera, support for rural health care, support for education. Those are the good byproducts of the program. Those things I would think you would want to preserve going forward with reform. Where the sparks really fly is the size of the fund, who gets the money, the accountability aspects of that, and then the long-term view. And I think for those of us in this room, the really challenge is the long-term view. And that's really up to a large extent, a lot of you and us to define on what that's going to look like and to match that with the policy goals of the country. And that is the hard part of this process. Really, the challenge, I think, is all of us. And our company, just a little bit of background on that, we're in 33 states. We're a holding company. We're in the process of acquiring or merging with Quest. That's another four states. We'll be 37 states, about 655,000 square miles of territory. And some of those, I've got markets as small as 34 customers all the way up to a million customers and everything in between. So there's a lot of diversity in those markets and how we have to serve them. We're primarily a rural specialist. We've done very good. We're about 91% enabled in some extremely rural markets. But as we get into universal service, a lot of what Mark said is correct, is that we're now at the challenge of evolving it to the next iteration of what we need to be. And I think that the issue there is getting our head around support for data versus support for voice. And that's really what's happening here, and that is where the differences are we need support for voice. There's no doubt about it. We would have some extremely high telephone rates for your constituents if we did not have that. But it is all moving to data. And the problem with data is it's not stagnant. It's evolving exponentially. And what that means for a provider like us is we are continually spending money on our network to meet consumer demand. Because when you send a packet or an email, the expectation is it's going to go where you send it, even on the other side of the world, and it's going to reach there instantly, if not quicker. And that is the expectation we all have to meet, Joel's company, my company, Shirley's companies. And so really what we're going down to is what we want the program to look like from both a social and a technical standpoint, and then realizing that, despite what Mark said, that the wireline infrastructure of this company, of this country, is really what's going to enable broadband faster and at higher speeds. In most of our markets, 4G is a Super Bowl commercial. That's about as close as they get to 4G because they don't have 4G. We also, in our markets, the cell phones don't work much off the interstate because of the rural nature. So someone's got to build to the unserved areas. That's where the focus needs to be for this program. High-cost areas that no one else wants to serve or can serve using their own checkbook. So there is a role for universal service going forward. It's just a matter of how big the program needs to be, the accountability aspects that go with the fund and the receiving the funding, and then evolving. Again, this is not a stagnant issue. Telecommunications has never been stagnant. So you've got to look longer term. Look at rural health care. Look at urban health care. Look at what's happening there. They're not doing that with wireless phones. They're doing that with fiber. And fiber and companies that are investing in fiber, to me, are the best hope for reaching those unserved areas and serving them in an affordable and also a reliable way. If you look at this natural disasters that take place, that connectivity is going to be critical for not only public safety, but also for our global economy.
So for those who just joined, John is from CenturyLink, and Joel Lubin is from AT&T.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to talk relatively quickly. I'm going to start by talking about what the customers want. And I'll be first to say what I'm about to say is probably presumptuous, but in terms of attending House hearings, Senate hearings, in terms of what various policymakers are saying, I think everybody wants two things. One is when you're in your home, you want the ability to be able to have what I call fixed broadband and download a lot of information whenever I want and download it to a big screen. And I also want the opportunity to have voices and application. When I leave the house, I still want to be connected. I want to be connected to mobility, and I want to be connected still to the internet, and I still want to see something on my handset, and I want to be connected through voice. So I think that's what the customer wants. How does it work today? I would say the current system is fundamentally broken. When I say broken, I'm talking about universal service and inter-carrier comms. It is not a transparent system. Our goal should be to find a solution that's transparent, clear, and understandable. I'm going to talk about that in my third point. And I would also suggest it isn't as hard as everyone who reads the various records on these items puts it out to be. Will there require any significant changes? Unequivocally, yes. When I say the current system is broken, what I want to highlight using FCC statistics is about 10 years ago, roughly 1999, there were approximately the ILECs who were serving.
ILECs,
thank you, independent local exchange companies, people that generally had the wired lines into your homes. They were selling service to approximately more than 180 million customers. That's a lot of customers. 10 years later, 2009, the number was slightly above 107 million lines. That means there's been over a 40% decline in wired lines sold by the incumbents. At the same time, households grew by approximately 14% from roughly 99 to 09. That means, because what Shirley highlighted was a carrier of last resort, you had to build out new infrastructure to new homes as your market revenues were declining by more than 40%. If I looked at this thing called access minutes, they were declining even greater. And so the current mechanism to support high-cost areas, be it through universal service or inter-carrier comp, is basically broken. I applaud the National Broadband Plan. I applaud the FCC's NPRM. Why do I applaud it? I'm not going to agree with everything, but it is a recognition that it has to change. And in my view, what they're attempting to do is figure out a rational, transparent system. For me, this is the third point I want to make, is that that rational, transparent system should be focused on, first of all, it's not a mandate. It's voluntary. You define what the supported service is. If it's X megs down, Y kilobits or meg up, define it clearly, succinctly. Define what the unserved, or I don't even like to talk about unserved. What I like to talk about are areas where there is no provider who is unsubsidized supporting the service versus an area that needs an explicit subsidy order to get someone to deploy the new investment or continue to want to serve using the sunk investment. So you define your obligations, you define the area, you define the supported service, you define explicitly what the obligations are, and then people will know if they want to serve that area, and if they serve the area, they sign up for the obligations. Bottom line is you can figure out a rational end game. Find that rational end game, then we will be successful in getting the broadband, whatever the supported service is, deployed in all of America. With regard to the issue of how much it will cost, that's a function of what speeds you define. And it's incumbent upon the industry to come forward and say, given various speeds, here's what the potential cost would be for those areas in which a editor doesn't show up and say, I'm willing to do that without subsidy. Let me stop there. Thank you.
Well, it might be criminal on my part as a moderator to fail to to note that the Federal Communications Commission has issued a notice of proposed rulemaking on reforming the fund. I think it didn't, my understanding is it didn't cover everything, but at least it's a start, and Joel was just referencing it. So as Uber cleanup, Blair?
Thank you. I actually want to start by apologizing Mr. Bob Bell. At a conference a couple weeks ago, I was talking about the broken universal services we were involved in. Pointing out that Rob often writes in the Wall Street Journal about how committed he is to free markets and capitalism. You can call this system many things. You cannot call it capitalism. You cannot call it free markets. But in referencing the fact that he had acquiesced in this climate commission and handing out billions and billions of dollars under this fund, I probably went overboard when I said that he was engaging in policies that Karl Marx would like, or was Marx-friendly. And I thought about it, and I realized that it's both wrong and inaccurate. Since what he really did was acquiesce to the wealth transfer massively from urban to rural America, I really should have referred to him as being mal-friendly. Bob, my greatest apologies. I'm kidding, of course. But I'm actually not. I want to make a couple of observations. First of all, there is that massive wealth transfer, but it's okay. In the telephone world, it was okay. It was the right thing to do. But I think we have to be realistic about what are the real things that we need going forward. And I agree with a lot of Mark and his on some areas that I, and the client gave us a lot of really great ideas. I mean, just to be a little bit about wireless, I think wireless actually will solve a lot of the problems, but the real opportunity for certain institutions like healthcare and education with two-way video are so great, we really do need wired connectivity to institutions. I'm not sure we need it for residential. I mean, 4G might do the job, may not, yes. But we certainly need wireline to all communities, and all the wireless networks who can be wired as well. So we have to think, we're going to have to pay more for addressing anchor institutions. Adoption, a much bigger problem in broadband than it is in telephone service. So we got to free up some money to do those kinds of things. But as to the rural issue, a lot of rural advocates like to talk about the rural urban divide. The big divide, as Tim mentioned, is the rural divide. The current system works the following way. We pay some phone companies, not money to produce a mass market, wireless, because the subsidy is so great, they only have to charge them. That's about 60% of the country. Our rural America. And then the other 40% we say, why? That's the current reality. That's the system that we need to fix. And so in the broadband plan, we set forth all aspects of regular systems. We did them. I'm sure we'll talk about the specific thing. I'm not saying I'm 100% correct that the numbers we used are right. I will say it's really important to get specific. Joel's exactly right on this. We have to have a plan that says, what is the technical parameters of the service that we want to subsidize? And then everything kind of follows from that, and then you can kind of look at it. And the single most important thing is right to do with the plan, you can look at the 136-page technical appendix to the plan, is try to tell people it's not so important that our answers are adopted as much as it is that people understand the trade-offs. And I have to say, based on I like the MPRM a lot, but the commissioner's statements don't reflect the understanding that there are trade-offs. If you choose four down, one up, it costs a certain amount. You can get higher speed, but then it's going to cost you a lot more. So people have to be really cautious in the trade-offs. We spent a lot of time in the plan trying to figure out what were the appropriate trade-offs. And I think that's the discussion that we have to be honest about what those trade-offs are and are not.
Well, let me just also suggest to the panelists that they can engage one another, challenge each other, ask questions. Looks like Bernard Cooper is already there to respond. I'm actually interested to hear what you have to respond, but I think it's interesting that Blair said that we're going to build a Maserati for what should be a Mercedes for the cost of a Corolla. Is maybe the wireless, your wireless proposal, Dr. Cooper, like kind of building is 4G really a Corolla?
Well, Blair takes issue with some of the things I say. We actually agree on most things. So I agree entirely that the common infrastructure for broadband is the highest priority. So in order to have wireline broadband, a wireless broadband, you need to have backhaul and middle mile to get to the community. And they share that. And that's a no-brainer. It ought to be every place.
And those are the hard lines that...
Those are the hard lines. That's the fiber that's going to get all that traffic that you're aggregating, even in a low-density area. The real question, and there's no doubt that that institutions in those communities probably need fiber. But those institutions are likely to be in the town, and therefore they're not very long runs, and the cost of hooking up those institutions is manageable. The challenge becomes when you get out into the really low-density areas, and are we going to pull as our first priority over the next X 10 years, are we going to try and pull fiber to every household in America? And the answer is that's backwards in my opinion. What we want to do is get them the best wireless service we can, and it's quite clear that 4G isn't out there yet, but I guarantee you, your head's going to spin how fast it gets out there if we get this policy right. Because it's a lot easier to get it out there, particularly if we give people access to really good spectrum. Right now, they're stuck on crappy spectrum, We've got a lot of really good spectrum in rural America that ain't being used by people who have licenses, or it's vacant, and we've got rules that won't let us use it. So for me, eventually we may pull a fiber to every household in America, but I like to tell a story. I've been doing this so long, two eternities, we agree, if you do the math. Some of the early telephone cases I engaged in rural states, one of the big issues was party line service. This was 1985, and there were still people on party line service. And you know what? By 1985, people in rural America had run out of patience. Party line service was unacceptable in 1985, and they wanted single lines. And they were right. In 1950 or 1960, they were not saying that. They wanted telephone service in 1950. And the economics of getting them party line got them telephone service much faster. Now, should we have transitioned more quickly over the 25-year period between 1960 and 1985? Maybe. I believe that's the way we do it now. And so for me, the difference between us is not that great. I do not accept the proposition that 4G is second-class service. It's first-class mobile computing. And everybody on this planet wants that.
The official NTI spectrum designation is not crappy. I think there's actually on the chart, there's actually
they call it junk. They call it garbage and junk.
But let me just go to Shirley and John, just fine. Then we'll go to Joel to kind of like flesh out how much is this thing going to cost?
Great. Thank you, Tim. So Mark, when you raise the whole role of wired and wired service and wireless in rural areas, I think there's a couple things that are really important. First of all, that infrastructure is valuable. You've got to have that fiber infrastructure. If you're going to do the things that we're talking about today, you really want to have people have the capacity to do the downloads that John was referencing and where you draw the line in terms of small businesses. A lot of the areas that we serve don't have some of those anchor institutions, but we're lucky if we've got a small rural healthcare clinic or a school or a livestock yard or something that's incredibly important to the community but may not qualify as what you call an anchor institution. The other thing that I think has been very interesting from an economic perspective is, particularly the cost of copper these days, as folks are doing their infrastructure upgrades, in a lot of cases, we've got a lot of studies now backing up the fact that if you're doing a dig and you're going through that, in a lot of cases, it's actually cheaper to put the fiber in than to try to upgrade your copper plant. And isn't that the most efficient use of some of those services? And last, what we would give to have access to some of that spectrum in rural areas. And that's the thing that I worry about, because we kind of talked about 4G, how great it is. Right now, it is very, rural carriers can't get their hands on spectrum, and that's the problem, right? We started years ago when cellular service first started. What the FCC did is they allowed smaller auction areas so that small carriers like my guys could go in, get the cellular licenses in their service territories, and provide the wireless service. Well, it's gone to more and more of a nationwide footprint model, which is great if you're a large carrier, but if you're a small carrier, not only can you not get spectrum, but the larger carriers aren't building out in your territory. So you're stuck, if the 4G model becomes the model, you're in the Netherlands in rural America because you don't have the spectrum and you don't have access to build it out. So then the question becomes, what do you have in second class?
If you look at my policy recommendations, I believe in the use it or lose it for beach fund spectrum. So if someone has a national license and they don't build out in your community in X number of years, and I would say 5, you ought to have access to it, and we'll figure out the way to set the price afterwards. The first point is that we have to free up that spectrum in rural America. Absolutely. Every inch of beachfront spectrum should be fully utilized as quickly as possible.
John?
I'd like to pick up on party lines. Mainly to make a point, Joel made, I think, really well, is when I first joined the company, we had customers, a lot of them in southern states that started with A and L and M, that had party line service, and when they were converted over to single line, they actually complained about it. My point being, it is that I think this is not a competition, I don't believe, between wireless and wireline, in that we have several million customers in 33 states. They're all different. And we're a market-driven company. We're publicly traded, very customer-focused. If we don't listen to what our customers want, then we're not really doing our job. And we have a lot of different requests. Joel, I think, is right on target. We have customers who have made mobile decisions about their voice quality and their service. and that they've cut the cord or whatever. But one thing about cutting the cord I want to mention is that if you'll notice Comcast and Cox, they're advertising phone service today. That's not by accident. They're not cutting the cord because they don't like wireline service. They just want a better price or a better bundle or a better package. So you actually see voice migrating not only to wireless but to the cable companies. I mean, quite frankly, most of ours or the majority of ours is going to cable because they're so competitive. But that said, this is a customer-driven process, and I think to mandate wireline or 4G to the home really sells America short from the standpoint of a lot of demographics, for instance. Most of our markets are rural. That means the demographics there, the population is mostly elderly, probably the same people that call you about their Social Security from time to time, and also they're lower income. I think they're going to want both. A lot of our customers want the wireline because as you get our age, you start needing reading glasses, the small screens don't look quite as good to you, and you were spending a lot of money on high-definition television that 4G cannot replicate, and also sound systems and wiring homes, home theaters, even farmers have man caves. You know, so you've got to realize that the demand is going down two diverse paths, and somehow universal service has got to find a way to fund both, because you can't mandate a technology on the American people because their needs are so different and unique by market. So I would respond to that way.
Okay, and I want to go to Joel, but first let's go to Blair, but then we'll go to Joel, and I want to ask Joel next about what's the minimum technical requirement we're going to need.
Blair? And I just want to make very clear points. If you're talking about using your money, great. The problem with universal service is it's not responding to the customer. You know, Shirley very kindly invited me to speak at to her convention, whether she regrets that now, I don't know. But you know, I sat there on the panel with these guys, and I said, should there be a limit on how much subsidy we go to a single house? And they said, no. They said, in fact, Blair, you didn't do what Congress asked because you didn't accommodate the last 150,000 homes. I said, that's right, because each of those homes costs more than $50,000 a year. So the objection that people like me have is not to you guys using your own private capital to figure out how to serve the customer. But when you come, and it's not your company, but when other folks come and say, well, the law requires it. You got to give us $50,000 a year, or $20,000 a year, or $10,000 a year. I think, you know, the government has to say, wait a minute, there's got to be a better way to do it, and that's what we're trying to do.
Joel.
For me, when I listen to all this, I just get fascinated of all the various points. Because when I listen to each individual, there's a part of what everyone says, and I say, wow, I can't believe that's true. And then sometimes people then take it to the extreme, and that's when I start to fall apart. And what I want to highlight is this is all about how much money. It's all about what the customer wants, how much is it going to cost, and for the people that live in rural areas, for Shirley's constituents, John's constituents, and me, I have, we've said, 7 million customers that live in rural areas. In the rural areas defined by the Census Bureau, so we don't get to define it, but I've got 7 million of those customers. And so the issue is, we're trying to figure out, how do I get this infrastructure out to them? But everyone else who lives in the towns or the East Coast, the West Coast, the square states, or wherever, you know, they're going to pay for it. And so now the question is, you know, do I do fiber to the home? Do I do fiber to the cow? I mean, those are questions, but there's a cost to it. We have to figure out the cost and then say, can society pay for that? And to me, that is what I liked about the National Broadband Plan and the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. And so all of a sudden, the question is on the table. And it's incumbent upon the industry, in my opinion, because as Blair highlighted before, they did an analysis. I applaud their analysis. It's the best thing that ever has been put in the record. Do I agree with it? No. Okay. But it's the best, and it gives me something to shoot for. And so it's incumbent upon the industry to say, for example, if I want fiber to the home or fiber to the cow, it's incumbent to say, how much will it cost? And so to me, the beauty is they teed it up, and they did something in addition. They basically made a couple of clear points. And I'll give credit to NCTA, that's the cable group. they said, hey, there's a pale guy there in the area, and they're not getting subsidy, and they're competing head to head with a supported service. If they're not a supported service, then it doesn't work. But if they are, then you shouldn't be subsidizing somebody else. So that to me is, hey, I got that. Seems reasonable. And so part of my theme is, can we use common sense here to a degree? And the other part is what Blair just highlighted, but the way it's translated in the NPRM, it says, will satellite be a satisfying service? If the answer is no, then there's no point in going further. But if satellite can support whatever the supported service is, and if it can offer voice, meaning it solves the latency problem, then maybe satellite for those really, really high-cost areas, because I've got really, really high-cost areas, so does John, so does Shirley, is it reasonable that for the super high-cost areas, and if, by the way, if they're 5 million, it's probably not going to work because satellite can't satisfy 5 million. But if there's a million or 2 million, this example was a quarter of a million that were really, really high cost. All I'm really highlighting here is we need to understand how much is it going to cost to explicitly have a viable incentive for someone to say, I want to serve that area. So we need to understand the cost. And when we understand that, the FCC is saying, I don't really want to support someone if they're competing against someone who gets no support. And then the other thing they say is, hey, can satellite really address the really, really high costs? And so you can calculate all this. And so I believe, once and for all, the industry has to come together and figure out a rational, coherent, transparent way to solve these issues and see if you can build a diverse approach that puts it on the table.
The title, I think we had, it was kind of an imperative in the title of this panel, which was, will somebody just please do it? Yeah. And so far we've gone through, 35 minutes, and I'm not sure how far away are we on this thing. I mean, Dr. Cooper's first slide is pretty compelling. So I guess the question is, how much is it going to cost, but what's the minimum service? I'm not even sure what you're saying. Satellite minimum service to subsidize? Or what is the minimum technical requirement that you would need to subsidize a universal service subsidy?
That's a great question. So the NPRM sees this question up and they tentatively say, by the way, there's no tentative conclusion. There's nothing that says tentatively.
But Joel, you're saying the industry needs to decide.
Absolutely.
Let's forget about what the FCC said. What do you say?
Right. So here's what at least we're going to attempt to do. What we want to do is answer their question by saying, if you pick 4 meg down and 1 meg up, and it's unserved, and you have satellite, let's say, for the top of the pass, how much does it cost? That number you can figure out. And then say, well, what if it's 4 meg down and 760 kilobits up? How much will it cost? What if it's 3 meg down and 1 meg up? What if it's 10 meg down? Put the data on the table, and then you have to ask yourself, what can society pay for? Because it's going to be on everyone's bill. And so, do I have an answer? Not today.
So you're going to answer the question with a question.
What I'm saying is that you have to make the quantification and put it in the record. And my personal view is, I think 4 meg down and 1 meg up, which is what they put on the table, I think is potentially going to cost too much. But my only point here is, it's incumbent upon the industry to put something on the table to save it. And when they do the analysis, if it turns out that it doesn't cost so much, well then fine, that's great. But to me the question is, am I going to support 100 meg to the end user? I don't really believe that's on the table for now. Maybe someday it will, but that's not the question. And so for me, when people put that on the table, it confuses the debate.
Okay. I want to push back a little bit on that argument that, and it's come up, Blair brought it up, and Joel just said it, it's on everybody's bill. But remember, this is a tax on everybody's bill. It's not a service for which people are willingly paying. And the interesting question is, so they tell me it's customer-driven and market-driven, and so that immediately raises the question in my mind. So I made it clear. I believe that wireless will meet his 4.1, certainly in the 4G phase. It'll probably double that, certainly down, if not up. And if they so desire, they can put enough towers to do whatever they want. So here's a proposition. So what were to happen if we were to say the customer is responsible for half of the cost? And then, you know, if I'm right in that $20,000 a year or $20,000 line and broadband is matched by a $2,000 a year or a wireless 4G, I suspect most people are going to buy the 4G for $1,000 and not the broadband for $10,000. At some point in the future, they may be otherwise. But so the interesting question is, how do we build market discipline into the universal service program? And if you look at our recommendations, we actually support building market discipline in on both the supply side and the demand side. On the supply side, we support reverse auctions, which means people can come in and bid for the smallest subsidy, which is what the taxpayer would like to pay. And on the demand side, we like vouchers for consumers, which means that if a consumer is presented with an offer for $1,000 a year versus $10,000 a year, they take their voucher and they buy, I suspect, the $1,000. So the real question becomes, how do we, if we have to have an efficient system, and we have to, then I would suggest we build market discipline into it. And let me be clear, the incumbent technology is dead. The incumbent companies are not. They can transition to the new environment if they are efficient suppliers of broadband. And it's sometimes really hard, I think, to understand that difference. So I really do believe that all those world companies will exist. They will just be purveyors of very different services.
Let me continue on because I want to go to questions. I will in a second. I'm sorry. I haven't gotten to my first three questions yet. You know, but I just want to get back to the cost question. You know, Joel has says, you know, four down and one up is probably going to cost too much. Dr. Cooper is saying that we can get there with more better spectrum policy with wireless. How much is it going to cost? Where are we? Because it's upsetting to me because I've watched a couple of administrations now come and go, at least in my eternity in this space. I remember a goal of 100 megabits by 2010 to 100%. 100 megabits by 2010. You're talking about four down and one up. So how much is it going to cost? What's too much?
You know, I actually agree with Joel. You know, a lot of this analysis has to be, you know, what are the different speeds? How do you want to get there? And you've got to be technology agnostic and facing the fact that some areas are going to be using more effectively different technologies than others. So the problem is I think you're looking for the magic number. And I don't think anybody can really throw out the magic number. I think the map that NTIA released was a great start. We're already getting feedback from companies that, hey, you know what, my state map was great and it was right. Now this national map does not really reflect kind of the broadband. So I think there's a lot of pieces that have to kind of come together. But I know you're kind of looking for, you know, throwing out a magic number there, and I think that's going to be difficult to do. The number it's not going to be is 50,000 and some of these other numbers that are flying out there. I do want to correct for the record. One of the things that had come up last year in the House Energy and Commerce Committee is they had actually asked for folks to file, you know, what their costs were. There's a company in Washington State that has 17 subscribers that has $17,000 per line cost. It's the one that gets thrown out in the press. It's an anomaly. It's a case of a company where there was no service out in that area. So I just also want to kind of lower the temperature a little bit about what some of these numbers actually really look like when you're starting to talk about cost and what you're looking at.
And John, if you want to jump in, then I'll go to the question, and then I'll come back to the elephant in the room is, you know, how are we going to pay for this?
Okay, well first of all, Blair, great work on the National Broadband Plan. Wasn't there an estimate? Yes.
I'll give you the numbers.
Okay, so he's got the number, I think. The FCC is the main thing, but that doesn't make you happy.
Okay,
he might have a number.
Yeah, just to give you the study, the model that we did, and people have challenged it, but as Joel said, it's something to go shoot at, or shoot. Anyway, that's fine. We used the 4-1, 4 down, 1 up. We found 7 million homes don't have it. To get it to those homes over a 10-year period would require require about $33 billion. It would, those networks would produce revenues of about $9 billion, meaning there was a private investment gap of $24 billion. The last 250,000 homes represent about $14 billion of that, and that's where we said satellites would do it. And so we basically said for $10 billion, we could solve the problem if you could find the compensating program. And then we said we have various changes in the system, such as cutting back, actually eliminating seed funding and doing some other things. It would have cost us about $15 billion. There's also some carrier comp and some other things in that $15 billion. So that's what we did. And I will say that we had one of the principal questions was kind of what's the design feature for your assumption about the size of the fund? And we started from the assumption that we wanted to do it within the current size of the fund. That's, you could argue with that, but I have to say politically, I think that if you talk to the commissioners, nobody wants to vote to increase the fund. There are various proposals to increase the funding base, but that doesn't really go to the question, and that's an important question, but that doesn't go to the size of the fund, which is what we were addressing. So if you have higher speeds, you blow those numbers, but is it worth it? That all depends on who you're asking, but we just want to be very clear about what's going on.
It will not cost as much as the companies claim or as little as the advocates say. and how much it will cost until you are out there deploying, unless you use a market discipline mechanism, you will never know.
Well, thank you for indulging me with my questions. I have a question here and then
here.
Yes, Sonia Wendell with NCTA. My question.
Which is the big cable thing.
Last week, Chairman Dennehaus, he said to answer a question to Congressman Dingell, he committed to getting USF reform done by the end of the year. Do you think that's possible, and what would need to happen to get it done?
I have seniority on this panel. I think I've been doing this longer than Joel. I mean, I think the really important thing that the FCC has tried to do is they set a 10-year goal. And if you adopt that policy, say at the end of 10 years, this is what we want the system to look like. And then they've laid out the transition. If they had to vote on every penny next week, you could never get it done. If you stretch it out over 10 years, you can do it. The key question then becomes whether or not inertia keeps you on that path. Because it's easy to say by the end of 10 years, these companies will have transformed themselves, they'll have to rewrite all their loans, etc. But in Washington, if the FCC acts, sets up a schedule, and says, starts that schedule, what happens is it gets harder and harder for people to say, let's get off this train. And so in that sense, I think it can be done because they've thought about it in the right way and hoping that once the train is moving down the track, it's difficult for people to jump off. That's why I talk about the end point.
So anybody else want to answer the question about the end? And I believe the end of the year you meant 2011, right? And also, if I could modify the question, like, could Congress help or hurt this process?
I think Congress has a role. And I think, I think that actually the industry is moving very constructively with the FCC. I think the NPRM came out last week. I know that we are working with all of the rural associations to be very proactive and come back to the FCC with real answers to their questions and actually a plan that we'd like to help put together to basically say, we see where you're going, you put out some guidelines, and here are our thoughts about how to drive forward reform living within your guidelines. I know that we've also been talking as an industry as a whole, and I think these are really important and constructive discussions. I think getting a bill through Congress while you've got this NPRM and the FCC on track, I don't really see the motivation for Congress to dive that deeply into it while you already have the FCC moving forward. But I do think members of Congress will all have specific interests in this, and certainly, particularly with the interest in broadband deployment in, all parts of their constituency, I think that's going to play a role in terms of as they watch the FCC. I think Congress actually doing a bill, I mean, this room, everybody sitting in those chairs may be better poised to answer that. I would think that would be very difficult to do by the end of this year.
Anyone?
I think it's certainly possible. I hope it happens. I think you increase the probability of. I was basically saying I think it can happen. I hope it happens. I think you increase the probability of it happening if a diverse group comes together and lays out a comprehensive piece. And the reason I say that is if one class of entity comes in and presents its plan, then you're going to have basically six plans. What you need here, in my humble opinion, is the inherent checks and balances of the industry debate trying to figure out what's a rational compromise so that you can have a complete plan put on the table. And through that process, there are inherent checks and balances. And if that were to happen, I think you increase the probabilities, I would think, I'll use the word significantly. With regard to Congress, that's not my area of expertise, but from my observation, this is a complicated process. Don't take the word complicated to mean it can't get done. It has to be get done, and if not now, when will it get done? And so when I say that, at some point when you're finished looking at what a comprehensive plan may look like, you may conclude, well, you know what, you can do that under the existing law, fine, go forward. There may, when you finally finish, say, hey, there may be a certain set of things that may require targeted legislation, but that is premature at this point in time to make that conclusion.
Hello, everybody. Eliza Craigman, Politico. To what extent do you think this is a technical policy challenge versus a political one of people, you know, losing money and or you don't see a lawmaker bring the FCC saying, my companies are getting too much money from this program? Is it reverse? This is the whole panel.
Well, the answer is you pass the law, you establish an independent agency to administer it. In theory, it ceases to be a political question. In theory, it ceases to be a political question. So the FCC can do whatever the heck it can get three big votes for.
And we need more of your expertise on this.
And, well, but the point is that, and we'll see if Congress can play a role, that means Congress has to act, which may not be so easy this year. If Congress can play a constructive role, that may be even more difficult this year. But as a technical matter, and Congress did this because they didn't want to have to deal with this kind of stuff. It took 14 years to write the 96th Act because it was entirely too political. So my answer is that the FCC can and likely will do whatever it can organize itself to do internally. Members of Congress are going to scream and shout, but they created the FCC for the very purpose of letting it take the heat.
I'll go for more questions, but getting to the big question on the table is, how is this going to be funded? And I appreciate you correcting me in my earlier statement that the Universal Service Fund is about an $8 billion fund. But the high cost one that we've been talking most about today is about $4 billion. So I appreciate that correction. That said, those are still big numbers. How do you fund it? You would say the existing funding mechanism is broken.
It's broken.
You have some options here. One is existing funding. You could increase the existing funding, even though that's actually decreasing. You could find a new revenue base, or you could ask Congress to just allocate more money. And my sense is that this Congress isn't going to be in the habit of giving up more money.
This is an off-budget item. Let's be clear. Congress doesn't allocate any money for these funds.
But it could.
It could if it wanted, and not. You're right, not these days. The Consumer Federation of America in 1996 supported the inclusion of intrastate revenues. Intrastate revenues in the base for universal service. Now, that was not a very popular position to take, because it meant that local phone bills would go up as well as long distance. But we understood that long distance could not fund it. So we believe that the base should be broad And now, and the court said no. We actually went all the way to court, and the court said no, it's interstate revenue, and that's all you can use to fund universal service, and that's why we have the mess we now have. So we believe in a broad base, and that is a tax on telephone users raised by, collected by telephone companies and transferred between telephone companies. In America, when you serving public purposes, that used to be popular. It turns out it's not that unpopular if you ask people about specifics. So we think the base should be broadened. Everyone who benefits from a ubiquitous communications network ought to contribute to it. And the internet is not an infinite industry anymore. It can certainly bear the burden of making sure that wires and the communication medium or media are there. So from our point of view, we believe in a broad base.
Let me ask everybody, how are we going to pay for this? And the contribution considerations. Blair.
Kind of just, we obviously address this or look at this with the plan. There are only three ways. One is you get a congressional appropriation. When we did our analysis, it came up with a $10 billion gap. We floated the idea of having Congress just one-time funding, take care of it. It would ease the transition and make a lot of things move a lot faster. We could have moved up the deadlines. To say that it was that we had no takers is to overestimate the amount of takers that we had. So, you know, we're totally pragmatic kind of people. We said that's not going to happen. The second way is that you change the contribution base, and this is what Mark is talking about. He is certainly right in the long term, but we chose to push that into what we call it. We had a 10-year transition. We wanted that in phase two. Let me be clear about why we did that. Number one, it doesn't really address the amount question. We want to do it within the current amount. But secondly, if you simultaneously change both the distribution and the contribution, we just thought that goes to the question Eliza and actually the person from NTCA asked. Politically, we just thought too many moving pieces. Distribution needs to be changed first, and the reason why is that there were a lot of we viewed them as low hanging fruit to reprioritize funding, and that you actually need to in the first instance stop doing things like funding 12 competitors in a single area in Mississippi. I don't know why we do that, but apparently under the current rules we do. There are some other things, you know, Shirley may be right about them, whether there are anomalies. Or whether, but there are big problems. You have to clean that up first. So that was our first priority, and that goes to the third way you fund it. You fund it by essentially stop funding other things, and that's what we chose to do. And we thought that was as a priority matter, the first priority.
And I would actually say I totally see Blair why you chose to do that. But in some ways, you could look at it and flip it around and say, well, if you look at what your contribution base is, then you can size, you know, what is the size of where you need to go? I mean, you can back into it either way. It would have been.
I don't thank you. I can't find anyone who has been elected to office who would want to vote there or appointed by the president subject to Senate confirmation who would raise their hand in a vote in which that vote would raise the size of the fund, no matter what the contribution base is. So it doesn't solve the problem.
And taking the contribution factor down, I think there's different ways you can do it, but as those who are carriers kind of look at how much of our bandwidth gets taken by different applications that now ride on broadband, you know, when you're at home and you're downloading movies and you've got people downloading all kinds of stuff that takes a huge amount of bandwidth, and how do we look at capturing and spreading out some of that in terms of the contribution base? How do you, you know, what do you do with Netflix? We actually had the gentleman, the CEO of Calix, come and speak to us recently, and, you know, Netflix takes up about 10% of every telco's bandwidth. That's a huge amount of bandwidth. How do you properly assess it so your residential consumers, are assessed appropriately while you're also getting those who are commercially benefiting from access to that network, that these universal service funds help build for the good of, you know, the community that, you know, whatever it may be. So it's a tough factor, and I would just say that we'd really like to see the FCC also grapple with the contribution side of the equation as well.
And I would say that is a recipe for absolute stalemate. I've now been in three appearances before world phone companies, and the tax Google option is extremely popular among them. Though I guess it's more fitting to the tax Netflix option, but But my only point is, again, that's an appropriate debate to have. I'm all for it. But it doesn't solve the fundamental problem. And if we have that debate at the same time we're doing distribution, I'm just telling you, I absolutely guarantee you they won't get it done by the end of the year.
John, Joel, you go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say this is the present system is obviously not the right answer. It's not keeping up with demand. I think Mark's right. The broadest base possible is the answer we're looking for. And you've got to realize that how traffic is flowing today and that all carriers, the value of the network is being able to complete a call. You can call Chatham, Louisiana from here and it goes through in a second or so and you get an answer, regardless of who you're calling. So everyone benefits from the connectivity. Everybody makes money from the connectivity. I think our biggest sensitivity has been is that I don't care how you slice or dice this problem, that everyone's customer is going to get part of this on their bill at some point. There's an indirect cost for the customer because it's a pass-through. Wireless passes it through. We pass it through. Most everyone passes it through. I think the main thing, the other thing, is that it goes into intercarrier comp. One way, I think, to take some of the burden out of this process in terms of amount of money is to get all the money on the table. There's a tremendous amount of arbitrage. There's a tremendous amount of payment avoidance and other things taking place on traditional legal compensation issues in the industry that keeps money off the table, that puts indirectly gets shifted back to the consumer again because it can't be accounted for any other way. So broader base, and I would say I'm somewhere between Shirley and Blair is that we would like to see it sooner. In terms of the sequence, I don't know exactly how that should work, but we would like to see that fixed.
Actually, I've heard Blair say this a few times. His answer, and I've pondered it and thought about it. I guess he basically has convinced me in the following sense, is that they're going to have an NPRM in the summer, and it has to get addressed. It's just, there's two fundamental core issues. How do you collect it, and what are the mechanisms for distribution? And so we're going to have a wonderful opportunity in the summer to debate this point. What we cannot let happen is let this opportunity that the National Broadband Plan puts on the table, now the NPRM, comments are, I think, are 45 days from whenever it appears in the Federal Register. This is such a critical issue, in my opinion, for the country. I mean, it's critical for my company, every one of these companies, but it's critical for the country to have a transparent, rational, coherent system. We debate access charges for the last 10 years, and I will assert to you that we're debating, is it a high minute rate, a low minute rate, really almost close to zero? Think about the following. Whatever the rate is times 0 minutes is zero. So, and some people say, well, then why do I have to care about it? Let it just die on the vine. And the reason you have to care about it is because you got to size the federal fund appropriately and target it so it's doing what it is supposed to be doing, and you have to rebalance local rates. In this country, we had local rates in the highest cost areas below the urban areas. I'm going to repeat that. The local rates in the highest cost areas were below the urban rates for this local service called plain old telephone service. That is broken, but you cannot have people thinking that POTS for $10 or $15 is a rational price point. That will ultimately be a barrier to adoption for broadband. So the reason I'm highlighting this is right now you've got 51 jurisdictions regulating this wired line into your home. You have two rates for this one line into your home. That has to change. We're not going to take the broadband internet access and say, oh, there's two rates, a state rate that's regulated by the state and another rate that's regulated by the interstate, and you add them together. That model is a dead model, and we've got to fix the legacy POTS regulatory paradigm, and this is so strategically important that if you want broadband to be everywhere, and that will be your connection to the government, that will be your connection to finding jobs, educating yourself. Today you buy newspapers for coupons, tomorrow you'll have the internet access for your coupons and better price points. If we don't solve that problem now, we are letting a significant opportunity slip through our hands. So that's why Blair has actually convinced me listening to him, why this issue needs to get fixed, and it needs to get fixed with a rational end game. And then we address...
Two observations. Back in the old days, two eternities ago, we used to think it was neat that we would let toll bills and business customers subsidize local access. And when people pointed out that, wait a minute, consumers pay that in the end anyway, our answer was, yeah, but those are discretionary services. So they're not necessities, and that consumers can consume less of that if they so desire without suffering the pain of not having a necessity.
You mean long-distance phone calls?
Long-distance phone calls, and also business customers. And they were passing that on to the consumer. The long-distance companies were passing the cost on. Come forward 25, 30 years, and the Netflix example comes up. And notice that when I suggest that we let Netflix, we tax Netflix, which is using the network, to help pay for the network, all of a sudden we get this complaint, wait, you're giving consumers. Well, but Netflix is a discretionary consumption of services, exactly like the old days of toll and businesses, right? And so it's the exact same logic that we used to use to justify whacking toll could actually be used to impose legitimate costs on high bandwidth users and say that's discretionary consumption. But we have difficulty bringing ourselves to do that. Second point on rate rebalancing. And this is a very esoteric topic. Nobody in this room understood a word that Joel was saying about rate rebalancing, right? But I want to suggest a different kind of rate rebalancing. Over the last 10 years, my graph showed you that a certain set of uses of the network were exploding in terms of their revenue streams. All of those revenue streams were pulled into and put in the federal jurisdiction. So the states do not have access to those to defray the costs of that access line. While all the revenue streams were being pulled into the federal jurisdictions, none of the network costs were brought along with them. So the FCC has run a scam here, folks. They pulled all the revenues into the federal jurisdictions. They left all the cost in the local jurisdiction. And now Joel's answer, he lives in the federal jurisdiction, so he likes that. He says, rebalance the rates. Raise the local rates. I say, maybe we should engage in a different kind of rate rebalancing. Let's bring some of the costs into the federal jurisdiction to offset all of those revenues. So, and nobody understood that answer either, right? But the simple fact of the matter is that you've got all these revenues here in Washington, and you left all the costs in Sacramento and Little Rock, right? I've got a different approach to rate rebalancing. This is only said to make Joel negotiate honestly with me so we can get a decent deal at the end of the day.
Well, let me go to Joel very quickly, and then let's have Blair, John, and Shirley do some closing thoughts and confirm or deny my opinion or my view that we're nowhere close to being done with this in 2011. Joel,
and so maybe this will surprise Mark, but I tend to agree that in the broadband world, I need to transfer that cost into the interstate jurisdiction. So I would say, you know what? Part of what he's saying, I'm agreeing with. But there's the other part. The other part is, well, some people are still buying plain old telephone service. That's the question here. If people go and buy the broadband pipe, he has a legitimate point. It should go 100% to the interstate jurisdiction. It doesn't necessarily happen that way. But that's the end game that I believe makes common sense. That, hey, it's in the interstate. You put it all in the interstate. But what happens to that segment of the population that says, you know what? For some reason, I don't want to buy that broadband pipe yet, or maybe never, and I have a POTS rate. And by the way, if I have the POTS rate, that $10 rate, $15 rate, I can show you $7 local rates in the high-cost areas. I believe that's a barrier to entry, a barrier to adoption for a certain class, probably no one in this room, but there is a certain class. That is not good public policy. By the way, this logically leads us to a lifeline discussion. And you need a robust Lifeline plan in broadband. That's the slippery slope. And my belief is put the facts on the table, put the cards on the table. Now is the time to figure it out. And don't use the albatrosses of the successes of the plain old telephone service that got it to 100% of the population. You can't let those albatrosses influence how we solve this problem for broadband. It's too important.
Well, let's go for the final thoughts. Let's go, since Shirley led off, let's go with Blair, John, and then Shirley.
So universal service, intercare, comperform is kind of like the Middle East peace treaty. You know, Clinton negotiated something in 2000. There was a recent negotiation. It turns out that all these negotiations end up about 95% the same. There's a little bit of difference at the margin, but everyone's just waiting for the right political situation to envelop. The truth is, I'm very proud of the work we did in the plan, but we really built on a lot of work that Joel and Mark and Shirley, others, you know, for 10 years, we really have known what we needed to do. There's really not that big an intellectual debate. This is fundamentally kind of waiting for the political leadership to get into the right place, not just at the commission and the Congress, but also in the companies and the trade associations. There's a big difference with the Middle East. As much as we might disagree about the margins, no one's going to blow themselves up. No one's going to shoot each other. But the question comes to, will the political leadership be there to do it? And I guess I would say I was actually a lot more optimistic about a year ago. I wax and wane in optimism, but it will happen if people simply understand it has to happen. Because then you make the trade-offs that you have to make, and you're willing to accept, you make a cut. You say four down, or you say five, or you say three. But you say something, you decide. And the important thing is, we have to get away from that kind of very aspirational talk that we would all agree with, but is completely irrelevant to the numbers. And in this regard, I would just conclude by noting that while I have a great deal of affection for and respect for all the commissioners, none of them, when they talked about this problem the other day, actually wanted to do math. They all wanted to do poetry. And when we have to get that, we have to force the commissioners to do math instead of poetry if we're going to get this done.
John? I think the main thing I'd ask that you take away from here today is to remember that there is a consumer impact to this. And again, we're in multiple states, and we have to look at it more from a service mindset standpoint, I think, as much as anything. The numbers are what they are. I think everybody's heard some large numbers. I think they see the challenges there. This is not an easy problem. And the lady that asked the question, by the end of the year, I would say no. But I think the good thing is we have a roadmap. The National Broadband Plan is a great roadmap to start off on. It may not be the perfect end game, but it's a great path. They've identified almost all the moving parts. The NPRM gives us great opportunity. We're a publicly traded company. Wall Street has not been mentioned in this conversation. There's a huge shadow over our industry right now. Is what is this going to end up like? We have plenty of analysts asking us that every day, wanting to know if we can see into the future, and we can't. So the certainty is a huge part of this. And I would just say this from a service standpoint. There's a stewardship issue with this money as well. And you need to look at the DNA of the providers in your local markets to see if they're creating jobs, if they're investing the money properly, if their service is good, if they're going down a broadband path, if they have a foothold in your state versus just a retail store. This is a long-term proposition, and you need to look for providers that are there for the long term, whether they're wireless or wireline or cable, whatever, it doesn't matter. But that's what you should be looking for from a policy outcome. And again, I'm giving poetry and not numbers. I realize that, but that's what I do best. But that is from your standpoint where you sit today, that's what you should be looking at. And then again, looking at the doctors and the small business owners and the residents and the elderly and things like that, the people who call you, those are the people who actually, everything we're talking about today, all this sausage making, they actually have to live with it at the end of the process. And so getting it right is very important, and getting it done quickly is equally important.
Sure.
I would just like to quickly add that universal service is critically important to getting broadband out into rural areas, and I hope we can keep our eye on the ball on that. And also just, you know, for those of you who work up here, you know, just continue to stay apprised of the FCC process, continue to stay apprised of what's going on in your congressional districts. And the last piece I throw out there is we should all keep our eye on the ball for adoption, because I think that's another important part of this equation.
Shirley? Well, obviously, I didn't get to all the things I wanted to get to and the questions that I wanted to ask. You could talk about Lifeline and some of the other issues. I'm actually thrilled that while you were dancing around the net neutrality question, I was wondering if we'd ever get through a broadband discussion without mentioning net neutrality. So we didn't. I'm actually pretty excited about that. Thank you very much for the panelists. There's a lot of sandwiches left out there, so take them back to your offices or wherever you're going. And thank you to everybody.